Desire. Why are we tortured by desire? Why have we made desire into a torturous thing? There is desire for power, desire for position, desire for fame, sexual desire, the desire to have money, to have a car, and so on. What do you mean by that word, desire? And why is it wrong? Why do we say we must suppress or sublimate desire, do something about it? We are trying to find out. Don't just listen to me, but go into it with me and find out for yourself. What is wrong with desire? You have suppressed it, have you not? Most of you have suppressed desire for various reasons, because it is not convenient, not satisfactory, or because you think it is not moral, or because the religious books say that to find God you must be without desire, and so on. Tradition says you must suppress, control, dominate desire, so you spend your time and energy in disciplining yourself. Now, let us first see what happens to a mind that is always controlling itself, suppressing, sublimating desire. Such a mind, being occupied with itself, becomes insensitive. Though it may talk about sensitivity, goodness, though it may say that we must be brotherly, we must produce a marvelous world, and all the rest of the nonsense that people talk who suppress desire, such a mind is insensitive because it does not understand that which it has suppressed. Whether you suppress or yield to desire, it is essentially the same, because the desire is still there. You may suppress the desire for a woman, for a car, for position, but the very urge not to have these things, which makes you suppress the desire for them, is itself a form of desire. So, being caught in desire, you have to understand it, and not say it is right or wrong. Now, what is desire? When I see a tree swaying in the wind, it is a lovely thing to watch. And what is wrong with that? What is wrong in watching the beautiful motion of a bird on the wing? What is wrong in looking at a new car, marvelously built and highly polished? And what is wrong in seeing a nice person with a symmetrical face, a face that shows good sense, intelligence, quality? But desire does not stop there. Your perception is not just perception, but with it comes sensation. With the arising of sensation, you want to touch, to contact, and then comes the urge to possess. You say, "This is beautiful. I must have it." And so begins the turmoil of desire. Now, is it possible to see, to observe, to be aware of the beautiful and the ugly things of life, and not say, "I must have," or "I must not have"? Have you ever just observed anything? Do you understand, sirs? Have you ever observed your wife, your children, your friends, just looked at them? Have you ever looked at a flower without calling it a rose, without wanting to put it in your buttonhole or take it home and give it to somebody? If you are capable of so observing, without all the values attributed by the mind, then you will find that desire is not such a monstrous thing. You can look at a car, see the beauty of it, and not be caught in the turmoil or contradiction of desire. But that requires an immense intensity of observation, not just a casual glance. It is not that you have no desire, but simply that the mind is capable of looking without describing. It can look at the moon and not immediately say, "That is the moon, how beautiful it is." So there is no chattering of the mind coming in between. If you can do this, you will find that in the intensity of observation, of feeling, of real affection, love has its own action, which is not the contradictory action of desire. Experiment with this, and you will see how difficult it is for the mind to observe without chattering about what it observes. But surely love is of that nature, is it not? How can you love if your mind is never silent, if you are always thinking about yourself? To love a person with your whole being, with your mind, heart, and body, requires great intensity. And when love is intense, desire soon disappears. But most of us have never had this intensity about anything, except about our own profit, conscious or unconscious. We never feel for anything without seeking something else out of it. But only the mind that has this intense energy is capable of following the swift movement of truth. Truth is not static. It is swifter than thought, and the mind cannot possibly conceive of it. To understand truth, there must be this immense energy which cannot be conserved or cultivated. This energy does not come through self-denial, through suppression. On the contrary, it demands complete abandonment, and you cannot abandon yourself or abandon everything that you have if you merely want a result. What is desire? Does desire bring about clarity? And therefore, that clarity is skill in action. In the field of desire, does compassion flower? You have to ask these questions. To find out the truth of the matter, you must examine what is desire, not desire for the object. The objects are not important. They vary. From childhood, you desire a toy, and so on. As you grow older, you desire something else. We are not discussing or talking over together the objects of desire, but actually, what is desire? If it does not bring clarity, and if desire is not the field in which beauty and the greatness of compassion flower, then what place has desire? You must go into it and find out, not according to any psychologist, any preacher, including the speaker, but go into it together to find out. We are insisting that we think together, reason together, find out together. Not I find, and then you accept or reject, but together find out. So, what is desire? The desire for a better society, and the cultivation of that desire becomes passion for an idea. People are so committed to communism, they are passionate about it, or any other form of ideological projection. So it becomes very important to go into this question of what desire is, not how to suppress it, how to run away from it, how to make it more beautiful, but just what desire is. How does it come about that human beings are caught in this? One year you are a Christian, or for 30 years a Christian. Then you throw that out and join some other label called Hindu or Buddhist or Zen or whatever it is. In inquiring, we must deal with facts, not with opinions, not with judgments. Then you have your opinions, and the speaker may have his opinions, and so there is a battle. Therefore, there is no communication. But we are going into facts, not your fact or my fact, but the fact that human beings have colossal desires, absurd desires, illusory desires. So what is desire? How does it come? Go into it. Look at it. You have your own desires, unfortunately or fortunately. Desire to be good. How does that desire arise in you. You see a beautiful woman or a beautiful man. See? Perception, the seeing, then the contact, then the sensation. Then that sensation is taken over by thought, which becomes desire with its image. Follow it yourself, and you will see it. You see a beautiful vase, a beautiful sculpture, a beautiful statue, the ancient Egyptian or the Greek, and you look at it. As you look at it, if they allow you to touch it, you touch it. See the depth of that figure as he sits on a chair or sits cross-legged? From that, there is a sensation, isn't there? What a marvelous thing. And from that sensation, the desire says, I wish I had that in my room. I wish I could look at it every day, touch it every day. There comes the pride of possession, to have such a marvelous thing like that. That is desire, isn't it? Seeing, contact, sensation. Then thought, using that sensation to cultivate the desire to possess or not to possess. This is obvious. This is not my explanation. It is a factual explanation. Now comes the difficulty. Realizing that the religious people throughout the world have said, don't look. When a woman comes near you, look at something else. Think of her as your sister, mother, God, or whatever it is. Laughter. You laugh, but you are born in this. You are conditioned to this. So all the religious people have said, take vows of celibacy. Don't look at a woman. If you do look, treat her as your sister, mother, whatever you like, because you are in the service of God, and you need all your energy to serve Him. In the service of God, you are going to have great tribulations. Therefore, be prepared, but don't waste your energy. But the thing is boiling, right? We are trying to understand that which is boiling. Not to look at a woman or a man, but that which is the desire, which is constantly boiling, which wants to fulfill, wants to complete itself. We said desire is the movement of perception, seeing, contact, sensation, thought as desire with its image. Now we are saying that seeing, touching, sensation is normal, healthy. End it there. Don't let thought come and take it over and make it into a desire. Do understand this, and then you will see that there will be no suppression of desire. That is, you see a beautiful house, well proportioned, lovely windows, beautiful garden, well kept, with a roof that melts into the sky, walls that are thick and part of the earth. You look at it. There is sensation. You touch it. You may not actually touch it, but you touch it with your eyes. You smell the air, the herbs, the newly cut grass. And can't you end it there? Why does sensation become desire? When there is perception, contact, sensation, it is natural, it is beautiful to see the lovely things, or an ugly thing. Then, to end it there, say, it is a beautiful house. Then there is no registration as thought which says, I wish I had that house, which is desire and the continuation of desire. You can do this so easily, and I mean easily, if you understand the nature of desire. Questioner. We know sex as an inescapable physical and psychological necessity, and it seems to be a root cause of chaos in the personal life of our generation. How can we deal with this problem? Krishnamurti, why is it that whatever we touch, we turn into a problem? We have made God a problem. We have made love a problem. we have made relationship, living, a problem, and we have made sex a problem. Why? Why is everything we do a problem, a horror? Why are we suffering? Why has sex become a problem? Why do we submit to living with problems? Why do we not put an end to them? Why do we not die to our problems, instead of carrying them day after day, year after year? Sex is certainly a relevant question. But there is the primary question. Why do we make life into a problem? Working, sex, earning money, thinking, feeling, experiencing, you know, the whole business of living. Why is it a problem? What do we mean by the problem of sex? Is it the act, or is it a thought about the act? Surely it is not the act. The sexual act is no problem to you, any more than eating is a problem to you. But if you think about eating or anything else all day long, because you have nothing else to think about, it becomes a problem to you. Is the sexual act the problem, or is it the thought about the act? Why do you think about it? Why do you build it up? Which you are obviously doing. The cinemas, the magazines, the stories, the way women dress, everything is building up your thought of sex. Why does the mind build it up? Why does the mind think about sex at all? Why? Why has it become a central issue in your life? When there are so many things calling, demanding your attention, you give complete attention to the thought of sex. What happens? Why are your minds so occupied with it? Because that is a way of ultimate escape, is it not? It is a way of complete self-forgetfulness. For the time being, at least for that moment, you can forget yourself. And there is no other way of forgetting yourself. Everything else you do in life gives emphasis to the me. Sex becomes an extraordinarily difficult and complex problem, so long as you do not understand the mind which thinks about the problem. The act itself can never be a problem, but the thought about the act creates the problem. The act you safeguard. You live loosely or indulge yourself in marriage, thereby making your wife into a prostitute, which is all apparently very respectable, and you are satisfied to leave it at that. Surely the problem can be solved only when you understand the whole process and structure of the me and the mine. My wife, my child, my property, my car, my achievement, my success. Until you understand and resolve all that, sex as a problem will remain. So long as you are ambitious, politically, religiously, or in any way, so long as you are emphasizing the self, the thinker, the experiencer, by feeding him on ambition, whether in the name of yourself as an individual, or in the name of the country, of the party, of an idea which you call religion, so long as there is this activity of self-expansion, you will have a sexual problem. First of all, why have human beings, right throughout the world, made sex so important in their life? Do you understand my question? Why? Now, in the West, it is permissive. Boys or girls of 12, 13 already have sex. And one asks, why have human beings, throughout their activities, throughout their lives, made this thing of such colossal importance? Go on, answer it. Put the question. We are sharing the question together, right? You are not just listening to a Delphic oracle, but together we are investigating. It is your life. We are looking at it. There is a whole philosophy called Tantra, part of which is based on sex, saying that through sex you can reach God, whatever that God be. That is very popular, and there are those like the monks, the Indian sannyasis, and the Buddhist priests who have denied sex because they have all maintained that it is a waste of energy, and to serve God you must come with all your energy. Therefore, deny, suppress, burn inside yourself with all the demands, but suppress it, control it. So you have the permissive and the so-called religious suppression. And those in between who enjoy everything, both sides, they have one foot in this and one foot in the other. Then they can talk about both things and see if they cannot harmonize the two together and find God, or whatever you want to find. Probably you will find, at the end of it, a lot of nonsense. So we are asking, why has man, woman, made this sex business so important? Why don't you give the same importance to love? Do you understand? To compassion, not to kill. Why do you give such immense value only to sex? Your wars, terrors, national divisions, the whole immoral society in which we live. Why don't you give an equal importance to all that and not only to this? Is it because sex is your greatest pleasure in life? The rest of your life is a bore, a travail, a struggle, a conflict, meaningless existence. And this at least gives you a certain sense of great pleasure, a sense of well-being, a sense of, you know, what you call relationship, and what you also call love, right? Is that the reason why we are so sexually crazy? Because we are not free in any other direction. You have to go to the office from 9 to 5, where you are bullied, where your boss is over you. You know, all that happens in an office, or in a factory, or in another job where there is somebody dominating you. And our minds have become mechanical. We repeat, repeat, repeat. We fall into a tradition, into a groove, into a rut. Our thinking is that I am a Christian, I am a Buddhist, I am a Hindu, I am a Catholic. You know, the whole thing is clearly marked, and you follow that. Or you reject all that and form your own routine. So our minds have become slaves to various patterns of existence, right? So it has become mechanical, and sex may be pleasurable, and gradually that too becomes mechanical. So one asks, if you want to go very deeply into it, one asks, is love sex? Go on, ask it. Is love pleasure? Is love desire? Is love a remembrance of an incident, which you call sex, with all the imagination, the pictures, the thinking about it? Is that love? Oh, for God's sake, is love a remembrance? You see what it is reduced to? Human relationship is pleasure, sex, conflict, quarrels, divisions. You go your way, I'll go my way. You follow? That is our relationship, actual relationship in our daily life. We are jealous of each other. We want to possess each other. We want to dominate each other. And so there is antagonism between each other. One is sexually unsatisfied. Therefore, you go to somebody else, and in that sexual relationship, there is loneliness, right? All this, and always seeking your own pleasure, is that all love? So you disregard, you put aside that thing called love. Perhaps that is the most wonderful thing, if one has it, and are so caught up in this vortex of one's own desire, of one's own pleasure, right? So we are always wanting not only sexual satisfaction, but gratification in every direction, which is based on pleasure. And that we call love. From love of a country, we kill each other. At the end of this, you ask why man, woman, have given this one thing such extraordinary importance. Is it that man, woman, have lost their creative capacity, not sexual capacity, creative capacity, to be able to see, to be a light to themselves, not to follow anybody, not to worship any image, illusion, belief? When you put aside all that, and you have understood your own petty little desires, which is your own sexual demands, gratifications, then, when you see all that, have an insight into all that, out of that comes creation. It doesn't mean painting a picture or writing a poem. That sense of ever freshness, you understand, having a mind that is fresh, young, innocent all the time, not clouded, burdened with all kinds of memories, dissatisfactions, fears, and anxieties. You know, when you have lost all that, there is a totally different kind of mind. Then sex has its own place. Apparently, we don't have that quality of skepticism. You understand? To be skeptical about one's own demands, to question, doubt. Happiness. Questioner. Are we not really seeking happiness? Krishnamurti. In answering this question, to understand it fully and significantly, should we not perhaps understand first this idea of seeking? Why are we seeking happiness? Why this incessant pursuit to be happy, to be joyous, to be something? Why is there this search, this immense effort made to find? If we can understand that and go into it fully, perhaps we shall know what happiness is, without seeking it. Because, after all, happiness is a byproduct of secondary importance. It is not an end in itself. It has no meaning if it is an end in itself. What does it mean to be happy? The man who takes a drink is happy. The man who drops a bomb over a great number of people feels elated and says he is happy, or that God is with him. Momentary sensations, which disappear, give that sense of being happy. Surely there is some other quality that is essential for happiness. For happiness is not an end any more than virtue. Virtue is not an end in itself. It gives freedom, and in that freedom there is discovery. Therefore, virtue is essential. Whereas an unvirtuous person is slavish, is disorderly, is all over the place, lost, confused. But to treat virtue as an end in itself, or happiness as an end in itself, has very little meaning. So happiness is not an end. It is a secondary issue, a byproduct, which will come into being if we understand something else. It is this understanding of something else, and not merely the search for happiness, that is important. Sensation is one thing, and happiness is another. Sensation is always seeking further sensation, ever in wider and wider circles. There is no end to the pleasures of sensation. They multiply, but there is always dissatisfaction in their fulfillment. There is always the desire for more, and the demand for more is without end. Sensation and dissatisfaction are inseparable, for the desire for more binds them together. Sensation is the desire for more and also the desire for less. In the very act of the fulfillment of sensation, the demand for more is born. Mind can never find happiness. happiness is not a thing to be pursued and found, as sensation. Sensation can be found again and again, for it is ever being lost. But happiness cannot be found. Remembered happiness is only a sensation, a reaction for or against the present. What is over is not happiness. The experience of happiness which is over is sensation, for remembrance is the past, and the past is sensation. Happiness is not sensation. Questioner, what is happiness? Is it not the search for happiness that makes the mind crave for new experiences? Is there a state of happiness that is beyond the mind? Krishnamurti, why do we inquire what is happiness? Is that the right approach? Is that the right probing? We are not happy. If we were happy, our world would be entirely different. Our civilization, our culture, would be wholly, radically different. We are unhappy human beings, petty, miserable, struggling, vain, surrounding ourselves with useless, futile things, satisfied with petty ambitions, with money and position. We are unhappy beings, though we may have knowledge, though we may have money, rich houses, plenty of children, cars, experience. We are unhappy, suffering human beings. And because we are suffering, we want happiness. And so we are led away by those who promise this happiness, social, economic, or spiritual. So we want to escape from what is, the suffering, the pain, the loneliness, the despair. We want to run away from it. And the very running away gives us experience, and that experience we call happiness. Is there any other kind of happiness? What is the good of my asking if there is happiness when I am suffering? Can I understand suffering? That is my problem, and not how to be happy. I am happy when I am not suffering. But the moment I am conscious of it, it is not happiness. Is it not so? Because the moment I know I am virtuous, I cease to be virtuous. The moment I know I am humble, courageous, generous, the moment I am aware of it, then I am not that. Happiness, like virtue, is not a thing to be sought after, not a thing to be invited. Virtue, when cultivated, becomes immoral because it strengthens the me, the I, leading to respectability, which is the self. So I must understand what is suffering. Can I understand what is suffering when a part of my mind is running away, seeking happiness, seeking a way out of this misery? Must I not, if I am to understand suffering, be completely one with it, not reject it, not justify it, not condemn it, not compare it, but completely be with it and understand it? Can I listen to the voice of suffering without projections? I cannot listen when I am seeking happiness. So my probing, my inquiry, is no longer what is happiness, nor if there is happiness beyond my mind, nor whether it is permanent or impermanent, nor whether it is an experience, and therefore to be stored. The moment I do any of these things, it is already gone. Therefore, it is no longer happiness. But the truth of what is happiness will come if I know how to listen. I must know how to listen to suffering. If I can listen to suffering, I can listen to happiness, because that is what I am. I suffer. I am fearful of death. I desire to be secure after death. I desire to be permanent. to have position, wealth, comfort. I am filled with the ache of loneliness. So can I listen to all that? Then my problem is no longer a way to happiness, but to find out how to listen to the voice of suffering, just to listen without trying to interpret it. And that is a very arduous process, because the mind continuously objects to living with suffering, to look at it, not to interpret it, not to justify it, not to translate it, not to condemn it, but to look at it, to know its content, to be acquainted with it, to love it. The mind is capable of listening to the voice which is beyond suffering, only when the mind is not running away from it into some futile imagination or illusion or some desire for satisfaction. So what is important is not if there is happiness, but from the very beginning to inquire into what suffering is, and to stay with that until the right answer comes. The right answer cannot come if you are seeking. The moment you search for the right answer, the mind is projecting, because it wants the answer. Therefore, it is not concerned with listening to suffering. It is not concerned with listening, but it is concerned with the answer which will reject this suffering. The moment you wish to reject something, then you will find an answer which will be satisfactory, and so it will be that satisfaction which the mind seeks, and not the understanding of suffering. After all, that is what we all want. We want satisfaction, either in a position, in relationship, or in ideas. And the more we are satisfied, the more the suffering. Because the mind that is satisfied is never let alone. It is always being challenged on every side of life. So a mind realizing that it is seeking satisfaction, the very desire to find an answer for suffering is to be satisfied, totally puts aside all this. Therefore, it is only listening, seeing the whole process of how the mind runs away, how it never can stay with suffering, such as facing fear. Fear comes only when you are running away from it. Fear exists in the process of flight, not when you are confronted with the thing. It is only when you are running away from the thing, in the very running away, fear is created, not when you are watching the thing, the what is. So, similarly, can I look at suffering without running away, which creates sorrow, which creates fear, which prevents me from looking at it? If I can look at it, then there is a possibility of listening to suffering without interpretation, without judgment, without translating or asking for a result. Then only is there a possibility of listening, of trying to find something beyond the mind. We cannot find what is beyond the mind if we do not know, if we are incapable of facing what is. And it requires enormous attention, great passive awareness, to observe without justification, without judgment, just to observe, just to listen. In that, there is transformation. In that, there is happiness, which is not measured by time, by the mind. When you see a beautiful thing, there is immediate joy. You see a sunset, and there is an immediate reaction of joy. That joy, a few moments later, becomes a memory. That memory of the joy, is it a living thing? Is the memory of the sunset a living thing? No, it is a dead thing. So, with that dead imprint of a sunset, through that, you want to find joy. Memory has no joy. It is only the remembrance of something which created the joy. memory in itself has no joy. There is joy, the immediate reaction to the beauty of a tree, and then memory comes in and destroys that joy. So if there is constant perception of beauty, without the accumulation of memories, then there is the possibility of joy everlasting. But it is not so easy to be free from memory. The moment you see something very pleasurable, you make it immediately into something to which you hold on. You see a beautiful thing, a beautiful child, a beautiful tree, and when you see it, there is immediate pleasure. Then you want more of it. The more of it is the reaction of memory. So when you want more, you have already started the process of disintegration. Joy is not pleasure. You can't think about joy. You can think about it and reduce it to pleasure, but the thing that is called joy, ecstasy, is not the product of thought. Haven't you noticed when there is a great burst of joy, you can't think about it the next day, and if you do, it has already become pleasure. So fear and pleasure are sustained by thought, given continuity by thought. How is one to look at great beauty, the beauty of a cloudless sky, the beauty of a sunset, the beauty of a face, the beauty of truth, to look at it and end it, and not think about it? We carry our pleasures and our fears. As a human being, you, the self, the me, is the burden of the fear and the pleasure. And you are afraid to lose that burden. A mind that understands the nature and the structure of thought is free of fear. And because it understands fear, it understands also pleasure, which doesn't mean that you cannot have pleasure. When you look at a cloud and a leaf, it is a pleasure to look. The beauty of anything is a pleasure. But to carry it to the next day, then pain begins. Joy is something entirely different from pleasure. You can invite pleasure. You can think about it, sustain it, nourish it, seek it out, pursue it, hold it. But you cannot with joy, with ecstasy. And that happens naturally, easily, without any invitation, this ecstasy, when you understand fear and pleasure. A mind that is really free of this, or rather understands it, then such a mind, which is with ecstasy, is never violent, is never ambitious, never seeking position, prestige, and all the rest of that nonsense. There is no duality in ecstasy. It is a state which spontaneously comes into being without our willing it. Suffering is an indication of duality. Without understanding this, we perpetuate duality through the many intellectual efforts and processes of overcoming it, giving oneself over to its opposite, developing virtues, and so forth. All such attempts only strengthen duality. If there is a lack of sensibility to ugliness, to sorrow, there must also be deep insensitiveness to beauty, to joy. Resistance against sorrow is also a barrier to happiness. What is ecstasy? That state of being when the mind and heart are in complete union, when fear does not tear them asunder, when the mind is not withholding. You cannot, may not, invite joy. If you do, it becomes pleasure. Pleasure is the movement of thought, and thought may not, can in no way, cultivate joy. And if it pursues that which has been joyous, then it's only a remembrance, a dead thing. Beauty is never time-binding. It is wholly free of time, and so of culture. It is there when the self is not. The self is put together by time, by the movement of thought, by the known, by the word. In the abandonment of the self, in that total attention, that essence of beauty is there. The letting go of the self is not the calculated action of desire, will. Will is directive and so resistant, divisive, and so breeds conflict. The dissolution of the self is not the evolution of the knowledge of the self. Time, as a factor, does not enter into it at all. There is no way or means to end it. The total inward non-action is the positive attention of beauty. When you look at a cloud, at the light in that cloud, there is beauty. Beauty is passion. To see the beauty of a cloud or the beauty of light on a tree, there must be passion. There must be intensity. In this intensity, this passion, there is no sentiment whatsoever, no feeling of like or dislike. Ecstasy is not personal. Ecstasy is not yours or mine, just as love is not yours or mine.